When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny.
Today, we are about to have an interview with Charles Gava, starting immediately, followed by a conversation between me and Arliss about a number of events happening in the U.S. today. That's all coming up here on Hopping Mad.
We're back on Hopping Mad, and we're so thrilled today. We want to welcome back friend of the borough, Charles Gava. Charles is the founder of the preeminent ACA fact-based website, acasignups.com. ACA signups started out as a lark for Charles, and it's hard to even remember those days. But I do. On Daily Coast, I remember when it was just a casual thing. He began tracking down the number of ACA signups on a state-by-state basis before anyone anywhere else in the country thought to do that, including, by the way, the government, of all things. And It was very interesting. I remember those very first blogs that Charles posted on Daily Coast and thinking, oh, huh, that's interesting, and not seeing that information anywhere else. Well, now his site is still where news organizations go for data. It's become the place that reporters, bloggers, and wonks get the latest on the ACA and get the basics of what's currently going on explained for them. Charles has been the most frequent guest on Hopping Mad, and we're honored to have him back with us again today. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you for having me again.
So this situation with the lawsuit in the Northern District of Texas, the federal court in the Northern District of Texas, can you set the stage on that for us and just explain how we got where we are right now?
Sure. So basically what happened was back in December of 2017, the congressional Republicans passed their infamous $1.5 trillion tax cut bill, right?
Yeah.
And as part of that, one of the provisions of it was that they reduced the ACA's individual mandate penalty, you know, the tax penalty that people have to pay if they don't have ACA-compliant health care coverage. They reduced that down from around $700 a person down to zero. Now, they did not actually eliminate the underlying requirement. They simply set the penalty for not hitting it from, you know, down to $0 or 0% of your income. And that is what led to, a couple months later, in February 2018, I believe it was, that 20 Republican attorneys general and, well, it was 18 attorneys general and two governors. I guess there's a couple of states where the governors are the ones who take that sort of thing. But 20 Republican state officials who filed a lawsuit claiming that because the Republicans eliminated the mandate, that means that the Republicans get to eliminate the rest of the law. That's what it boils down to.
So this whole thing, I mean, I understand this comes back to the Roberts court ruling that the ACA, the individual mandate, rests on Congress's right to tax. And Roberts backed that. So that kept the ACA in place at the time. And so now these guys are going after that. And so the other big issue, though, is that when the judge came back, the judge has come back with his ruling, and he said not only does the personal mandate, is the personal mandate unconstitutional, but the ACA is as well. What is that?
Yeah, that's the part. Okay, there's several ways that this lawsuit is absolutely insane, and just about every legal scholar and constitutional expert from across the ideological spectrum. I mean, there are hardcore conservatives who say this as well, that it makes no sense whatsoever. There are several reasons for that, and the that's one of them. The first is whether or not the underlying mandate itself is unconstitutional without, you know, an actual dollar amount attached to it. The second is there's also the severability business. And what that means is that the argument is that if the mandate itself is unconstitutional, that means that the entire law is unconstitutional, that there's no way of severing it or separating that one element from the rest of the law. And that's the part that even hardcore conservative Republicans who know their stuff, you know, the legal stuff, have said that there's absolutely zero, that makes no legal sense, that of course it can be severed. And frankly, the way that we know for certain that it can be severed is that it was.
Right.
The ACA is still around. The mandate penalty was set to zero as of January 1st of 2019. That was when it actually went into effect, was this year. And there's still around 11.5 million people who enrolled, and there's still, you know, there's still around 10 million people who are enrolled in exchange plans. There's still around 15 million people on Medicaid expansion. You know, the earth did not open up and swallow the country as a result. Now, it did damage to the law. It increased people's premiums by about, those who don't receive subsidies, they're having to pay around $600 more.
Yeah, tell me about that.
So it did cause damage to it, but it did not kill the law. And there are so many elements of it, like I said, you know, Medicaid expansion, reduction of pre-existing conditions, and a whole host of other things. None of those have anything to do with the mandate penalty.
So where does this thing go next? Does this thing go straight to the Supreme Court from here, or what's the next step?
No, so the next step is, so this was one judge who made a ruling. A guy named Reid O'Connor, who's a right-wing, ideologue type, and he made his ruling back in December. But then he ruled that the whole ACA has to go down. But he then put a stay on his ruling pending, you know, the appeals process, which is, you know, pretty standard, and, you know, that part's fine.
But this is the fifth district, right? This is the most conservative federal district in the nation.
Right. So the next step is now it gets bumped up to the full, I believe it's the full Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And that's not by accident, by the way, right? They venue shopped this thing.
Yes, it was definitely filed in this particular area for that reason. And so it goes to the full Fifth Circuit Court, and they have set I believe oral arguments are supposed to be in early July. So basically nothing actually happened. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff behind the scenes where they do filings and all that on both sides, but the actual oral arguments don't happen until this summer. And then they'll hear their oral arguments, and then they'll issue their ruling. And again, most even conservative pundits and legal experts are fairly confident that the full circuit will shoot it down on appeal. But here's the thing. Regardless of how they rule, up or down, the losing side is then going to try to appeal it to the Supreme Court.
Right.
And the Supreme Court, you know, then they will, whichever way the Fifth Circuit rules, the Supreme Court will either agree to hear it or they won't. And the general conventional wisdom, which is never wrong, of course, thinking is that...
I'm sure President Clinton would agree with you on that.
Right. But the general assumption is that if the Fifth Circuit shoots the lawsuit down and thus preserving the ACA, that the Supreme Court will probably not agree to hear it. And they'll say, that's it. It's safe. You know, lawsuit's shut down. ACA's still lives. And that's it. And that they probably won't even agree to hear it. In no small part because, you know, John Roberts, he's gone through this nonsense several times before. You know, the last thing he wants to have to do is they have to hear, you know, again, another major lawsuit about the ACA. But again, you never know. And so so if the Supreme Court does agree to hear it, then that could take, you know, I don't know what the calendar is like, but I believe that could take another like 6 to 9 months before that happens. And then you're into spring or summer of 2020, and now you're
right.
In the presidential election. You know, and yeah, so it's so once again, for like the eighth or ninth time, we're in this sort of Damocles dangling over everyone's head situation for months at a time. So let's see.
So it's not just us that have the sword of Damocles hanging over our head. It's also insurance companies, right? Because almost more than major disaster, insurance companies hate uncertainty. And aren't they? It's my understanding that it's about this time of year, I always think of it in the spring, that insurance companies are starting to put together their pricing for the marketplaces? Or do they do that later in the year when they, I guess they won't know any more about this later in the year, but.
You're absolutely right. And they actually do start now. I mean, in fact, it varies by state. There's different deadlines for different filing, deadlines state by state. But it's a multi-month process. It's not like it all happens in one shot, because there's negotiations and there's tweaks and modifications throughout the summer. But I believe Virginia has the earliest deadline, and that actually is in April for their very first draft, with the initial filing. Usually sometime in April. So yeah, within the next few weeks, at least one state is already going to be submitting. The insurance carriers are going to be submitting paperwork to the state saying, here's what we think things are going to look like next, in 2020. And here's what we think, we're going to have to raise prices, this much on these plans, and we might actually lower them on these plans and so forth. So yeah. And then that goes throughout the summer and into the early fall. And there are constant changes throughout the process, but there are hard deadlines that happen, usually in August or September. And after that, then they're locked. They're locked in for the following calendar year. And yeah, so I know it's not many people have a lot of sympathy for health insurance companies, but the fact of the matter is they are businesses, and they are trying to run a business, and they do have to have some idea of what their expenses are going, what the landscape is next year. And of course, they want very favorable, rules, but they still need to know what those rules are, whether those rules are, whether they get away with a lot or they don't get away with anything. They need to know what what it is. And once again, they don't know exactly. And so, again, they're trying to make decisions in April of 2019 based on what the situation is going to be in January of 2020, with this, again, this massive uncertainty dangling and sort of hovering around again.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I kind of have the feeling that even with Gorsuch on the court, that Roberts doesn't want, I haven't gotten any sense from his ACA rulings that he's dying to take health insurance away from 25 million people.
No, he does. And I believe a few weeks ago I saw there was some story, I don't know if it was Politico or somewhere, there was some sort of behind the scenes, maybe it was a new book that came out or something, that went into, that they had sort of the inside scoop supposedly on the, how that decision back in 2012 was decided, where the, where the ACA was preserved, but Medicaid expansion was made, optional, it was made up to the state. And supposedly there was a deal that was sort of brokered between Roberts and, within the Supreme Court itself. The fine is a tax, but we'll also, it's like the Medicaid expansion was thrown as a consolation prize. I don't know whether that's true or not, but if it is, that would, I could understand it because, at the end of the day, he didn't want to be the bad guy, and I don't blame him. But also constitutionally, it's not so cut and dry. That's the thing, is that it is open to, if it wasn't open to interpretation, we wouldn't need judges,
Right.
So that's their job. Their job is to judge mitigating circumstances, and that, not everything is exactly black and white and so on and so forth. So, so there was a lot of, claims that, he politicized the court. Well, it's kind of always been politicized. Anyone who says that, the courts are, completely above and beyond, politics.
Anyone who says that hasn't listened to Armando rant on that subject.
Yeah. But again, there's also the fact that, reasonable, you know, things like, we have concepts like reasonable doubt, right? That is a legal concept.
Yeah.
There is wiggle room, you know, within jurisprudence. So, you know, there is the question, would a reasonable person think that this makes sense? You know, even if a law says, if the exact letter of the law says, you know, X, Y, Z, does that mean that there's absolutely no possible circumstances under which it could be anything else? And, you know, that's, so that's where we're at.
So, go ahead, Will.
So in regards to the court cases going through, what are sort of your views on the best case and worst case scenarios? And are there other ways this could shake out other than a binary choice between, you know, 25 million people losing healthcare? Are there decisions the Supreme Court could make that would modify this, but not take healthcare away from folks? Like, what are the potential outcomes of the situation?
Sure. Well, so first of all, again, we're assuming here that it does make it to the Supreme Court, right? That it doesn't end up, you know, getting stopped dead at the
Supreme Court. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so there are a couple other possibilities. For one, the big story last week, right, which is, I assume, why we're talking about this today, was that the Trump's Justice Department sent this memo out to the Fifth Circuit, letting them know that, hey, we've changed our minds about what we want, and we now want the entire law killed, right? And that was the big story, was that memo. Now, the thing is, that memo was legally required to be submitted on that. That was the deadline, by the way. It was March 25th. That was the last day that they could submit this.
Oh, man.
Filing. And so the reason that made a fuss is that the original argument, the thing that people have to remember is that the Department of Justice is supposed to defend against this type of lawsuit.
Yeah, they're supposed to defend the laws passed by Congress.
Supposed to defend the law of the land, even if they, you know, even if the people doing it don't like it. You know, obviously Trump hates the ACA, and it's, you know, Jeff Sessions last summer, you know, they're all Republican, they don't want the ACA around, but legally they are supposed to defend it anyway. And it was actually, the bigger story was not, believe it or not, what happened last week. It was actually what happened last summer, which was when the Jeff Sessions was still Attorney General at the time, and his Justice Department, they said there was an earlier deadline or earlier filing date or whatever, and that was the point last, I think it was June or July, where they said, they basically said, we're going to throw the game. You know, we're going to throw the fight. You had the plaintiffs came in, the 20 attorney, Republican attorney generals came in and said, we want the entire law shut, you know, made ruled against. And the Department of Justice was supposed to have some lawyers who come in and say, well, no, we are defending against this lawsuit. And instead what they did was one guy, I believe, resigned. And a couple of other, and they basically brought in people who were sort of lower on the totem pole to represent the Department of Justice. And they came in and they basically said, yeah, we agree, except that we actually agree with the plaintiffs, but we don't want the entire law shut down. We just want, with air quotes around just, we just want the protections for pre-existing conditions to be shut down. We want the rest of the law to stay, but we just want the pre-existing, you know, guaranteed issue, community rating, essential health benefits. Those they wanted tossed out, but they wanted the rest of the law to stay in place. So the official stance of the Department of Justice was that they wanted most of the law to stay, but only part of it to be gotten rid of. Now, that in and of itself is hugely troubling. That's a massive problem.
Sure. Because,
again, if the Department of Justice refuses to defend the existing law of the land, that could apply to any law, right? And when an authoritarian, you know, president who wants to become a dictator, well, that's a real problem. But in terms of this particular case, that was their official stance up until last week. And then last week was when they basically said, you know what, screw it, kill the whole law. And that was what caused, you know, a huge outcry, a huge fuss. Personally, I'm actually surprised, a little surprised, that it made that much because their actual stance really, like, it's not that it wasn't horrible, it's that it was already horrible, you know? I'm not sure why there's been so much more of an outcry now than there was last summer, but whatever, you know, there should have been then. And
do you think it may have to do with the complexity of the situation? Like, it seems like it's just tinkering if they're trying to take down an important piece and sort of death by a thousand cuts attack Obamacare. And that's too complicated for people to really understand and talk about because you know, most journalists aren't educated on these legal issues. But then when it's the whole law, that's an easy story to tell. So
that's part of it. You're probably right, because the thing is, at the time it sounded, oh, well, that doesn't sound too horrible. You know, they're going to keep Medicaid expansion and they'll still have subsidies, right? You know, they'll still have all this other stuff, except that, first of all, the whole pre-existing condition protection part, that's like the number one issue that the Republicans got their asses kicked last November.
Right. Big.
Existing protection freezes. So that just in itself was already insane politically, as well as practically. But also from a logistics mechanics perspective, think about what that's saying. If you just looking at the you know, the exchanges, right? You know, the ACA, healthcare.gov, you know, the private policies. The whole idea is you have these standard plans that cost the same. You know, everyone pays the same price for the same policy with the same requirements. And the only differences are where they live, how old they are, you know, and then like if they smoke, like, but that's it. Otherwise, they're locked in, right? And so the subsidy formula, the way that they calculate how much, you know, financial assistance people get is based on how much there's a benchmark plan, right? A silver plan, and it costs this much. And if that cost is more than this percentage of your income, here's how much you get in financial help, right? That's what it's based on. If you take away the guaranteed issue, you know, the very things they wanted to get rid of last summer, if you take all that away, then there is absolutely no way of calculating what the subsidies would be. It's just logistically impossible. You would have to calculate, because there's no benchmark. There's nothing,
right.
Nothing to base it on. So what you would have to do, and I was talking about this with some other healthcare wonks at the time, we were speculating about how could this possibly be done, and what they figured is, okay, what you'd have to have is each individual enrolling, right? You, your spouse, your kid, each of you would have to be medically underwritten, again, which means that you have to submit all your medical history, all your x-rays, all your prescriptions, all your doctor's appointments to the insurance company, and they'll have an actuary go over all that paperwork. You know, this is what they used to do, right, before the ACA, was they would come up with a customized, specific, you know, premium just for you, right? And if you were healthy, it might be lower, and if you were, you know, sick, then it would be higher. And then they would have to use that and then base your premium on that and then calculate your financial assistance based on that. And that would have to be done for all 11 million people individually. It would be a logistical nightmare. You'd have some people who might be, you know, if you have someone with cancer or something, they might be, their official premium might be, you know, $20,000 a month, and then they get $19,900 a month in subsidies, you know? So, yeah, even before last week's change, it would have basically made much of the law unworkable anyway, even if they, you know, even if they officially cut less.
So, what is going on? So Trump last week, Trump swerved one way and then he swerved back. And now he's saying that, you know, don't worry, everybody, we're going to cover pre-existing conditions. And meanwhile, McConnell is saying, we're not talking about health care for one second between now and the election. And the GOP, when reporters checked with this committee to create a healthcare plan that Trump has supposedly put together, nobody knows who those people are, including Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary. Nobody knows anything about this. And what's going on? I mean, there's no possible way he can cover pre-existing conditions, correct? You can't just you can't cover pre-existing conditions without a whole other structure around it, can you? Well, I guess you can, but...
He could do a complete 180 and suddenly jump on board Medicare for all, single payer plan, I suppose. I'm sure that's what a lot of, single payer purists were thinking back in 2016, where they're like, well, Hillary doesn't like single payer. And Trump said, during the campaign, there was an interview where he just said, the government's going to pay for it all. Well, he lied, but, I guess there might have been some people who were thinking, his tiny little pea brain is so, it jumps around so much that who the hell knows? Maybe through sheer random chance, he might actually decide, screw it, single payer, there is no plan. The only plan that, they're claiming now is that they're going to go back to the Graham-Cassidy bill that fell apart, a year and a half ago. That was one of the last ditch, of the five or six that they threw against the wall. That was the last one that, before it all petered out. And that's what they seem to be doing. It looks like they're trying to hobble that back together. It's, of course, never going to go anywhere in the House, even if it made it through the Senate. And McConnell, it sounds like, they got their butts kicked, and not in the Senate, but in the House. He knows that they got burned badly on it, so he apparently is, smarter than Donald Trump, that's for sure.
Well, and it's an uphill battle for him to hold the Senate this next time, so...
Yeah.
This is not funny for him.
Yeah, and so that being the case, the whole situation with Republicans having been burned by this, how are they feeling right now that we're having this fight again when it's something they've already gotten their asses kicked on?
Well, you'd have to ask them, but my suspicion is not good, Bob.
Well, and the truth is, Trump isn't wrong. They can just pass a bill saying insurance companies have to cover pre-existing conditions. As long as they don't limit the rates on that, insurance companies will say, okay, we can do that. Here's your $30,000 a month premium that's not underwritten by the government. Go for it.
Yeah, and that's one of the most frustrating things during the whole repeal replace saga, 2017, 2018, when it came to pre-existing conditions, was that there's really, it's not just, guaranteed issue is only one of the, I have my I always use a three-legged stool metaphor, the guaranteed issue leg is what we're talking about, except that it's not all one piece. It's actually about a half dozen different chunks of that leg. Guaranteed issue, as you said, all that means is, they are not allowed to deny you coverage. They have to sell something. They have to sell the policy to you. It does not have anything to do with how much they can charge you. It does not have anything to do with what's included with the policy. And that's where you get community rating, which means that they have to sell, that they can't charge you more because you're sick or because you have medical history or issues or family history or whatever. It means that they have to charge you the same amount, within very limited parameters. It also requires the essential health benefits, right? Which means that, because the other thing that they would do before the ACA is, in some cases, they wouldn't sell to you at all, right? If your guaranteed issue comes in. In some cases, they would say, we'll sell you this policy, but we're gonna charge you 10 times as much for that same policy because we think you're gonna be expensive. That's community rating, says you can't do that. And the third, thing that they would do sometimes is they would say, we'll sell you this policy and we'll sell you at the same price as we normally would, but in your case, we're going to eliminate one of the things that's covered by it. And that thing just happens to be the very thing that you need it for. We just won't cover mental health services the reason you want the policy is because you need mental health services.
Yeah.
That's the essential health benefit. And there's several other provisions as well that are required by the ACA. They have to cover a minimum of 60% of your medical expenses. The metal tiers, bronze, silver, gold, platinum.
Lifetime caps.
Right. But the annual, right, that's the other big one, is annual lifetime limits and coverage. They used to put a cap of, you know, and then once you hit that cap in claims, then that was it, you're done, and you don't get any more coverage. And they would put it like it might be $1 million, right? They say, oh, you get $1 million of coverage. That sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But, you know, my kid was, my son was premature, prematurely born, and so he was in the neonatal unit for a couple of weeks after he was born. And, you know, it cost like, I think it was something like the official cover like $50,000 a day or something.
Right.
So there are children who used to max out their lifetime limits before they even came home from the hospital.
So. Yeah. It's insanity. So that pretty well brings us up to where we are now, correct?
I think so. You know, okay. One thing I noted last week that was really interesting in timing is that the House Democrats, you know, Nancy Pelosi and the House Dems, they did this big press conference where they rolled out what I call the ACA 2.0 bill.
Yeah.
It's actually a suite of bills that would basically substantially beef up the Affordable Care Act. The timing of that was really, really interesting to me because the 9th anniversary of the ACA, you know, when President Obama signed into law, was actually March 23rd, right? And there was a bunch of, there was like a hashtag and, you know, ACA at 9 or whatever. There was a bunch of stuff that happened that Saturday. But this press conference was actually held 3 days later on the 26th. And I, at the time, I was thinking, wow, that's, why would they, you know, you would think that they would time it for the anniversary, right? And then I realized that memo from the Department of Justice was released the night before on the 25th.
Right.
And a lot of people are like, oh, that's a weird coincidence. And I'm like, no. I looked at the deadline from the court, from the Fifth Circuit Court. That memo was due on the 25th. So there's part of me that wondered if Nancy Pelosi was like, hold on.
Pelosi always has a plan. I keep trying to tell people, Pelosi always has a plan. It may not completely work, but she's always got a plan.
I have no idea whether that's what she, whether that was delivered or not, but in my head it was.
Yeah. I do think ACA 2.0 is interesting because it's a really good approach for the Democrats. In other words, we're going to propose these things to improve ACA until we can get, you know, one of these other, you know, and there's an array of them, one of these other even better plans through. And I think that's how rational people work. In other words, we, you know, we understand that we're not going to get it all at once, but we're trying really hard. And the next thing we want, you know, the next steps, the things we know we can improve in the short term are right here in front of us.
Yeah. And I've been, this is the approach that I've been pushing for several years now. The thing that I think people have to keep in mind is let's say that you are absolutely a diehard, you know, Medicare for all, single payer, you know, advocate, right? The earliest conceivable time frame for that would be, you know, assume the best case scenario, blue trifecta 2020, right? Keep the House, we take the Senate, we take the White House. They take office in January 2021. Let's say that you have a bill ready to go, it passes the House, it passes the Senate, it's signed by the new Democratic president, right? It goes into effect starting in January of 2022.
Right.
And it takes several years to ramp up. Even Bernie Clinton takes 4 years. The House plan supposedly would take 2 years. I don't know how they do that. But, so between now, 2019, you're still talking at a minimum like 3 to 5 years, let's say, you know, where we're going to have the current, you know, general framework with the ACA.
Right. So if you're 26, it's 2025 or 2026 or 2027 before Medicare for All gets to you.
Right, and that, again, that assumes that this all assumes that it all goes through, you know,
perfectly fast, yeah, and nothing ever works that way.
So we definitely need to have, you know, the ACA. If you don't do anything else, basically the ACA is going to sort of hobble along for the next several years, and you know, again, that's certainly better than tearing it down, but it definitely needs to be beefed up in the means, even if it's only for, you know, a few years, even if it's only a short-term thing. does need improvements. And so that's where they're going with it. Now, obviously, the suite of bills that they proposed last week, that's very unlikely to go through the Senate side. And certainly Donald isn't going to sign it since he's trying to tear down the law. But they have it ready and they're rolling it, but at least they're presenting it and say, here's what we're thinking. Here's how we think it should be improved, for the next few years anyway, until we can get, and the big fight is, Medicare for All or Medicare for America, which is my preferred bill. Or, as you said, there's about half a dozen swirling around. Whatever the next big thing is, this is what we want to do until we get to that.
Yeah. Well, Charles, thank you. Thank you again. We really, these things come at us kind of, we're paying attention to so many things at one time. And yet something important like this rolls up in front of us and it's hard to go backwards and understand what's going on exactly because we've been watching other balls. We've got all these balls in the air. We've been watching those things and thank God experts like you are just watching the ACA and so finally focused on where that's going.
Yeah,
we
and
really
to then,
appreciate it.
We do. And to that end, I just want to ask, is there anything we haven't asked you that you think our listeners need to know about
question.
This specific situation?
Are you talking about the lawsuit in particular?
The lawsuit, the current status of the ACA, anything we haven't covered
there's all sorts of other ACA stuff going on, but this is obviously the big picture. I mean, probably the three biggest ACA specific stories at the moment. Number one, of course, is the lawsuit. Number two is on the positive side is the ACA 2.0 proposals from the House Dems. And the sort of the third kind of bigger story, especially last week, was regarding Medicaid work requirements. There's also a court ruling on that. Actually, there were several about some other things as well. But yeah, the whole Medicaid work requirement thing is that's sort of the other leg of the Trump administration's attacks on the ACA is on the Medicaid expansion side. And so there was a big court ruling last week that a federal judge again shot down work requirements for Medicaid expansion.
For the sixth time, right? I mean, doesn't this just keep – this is Groundhog Day with that, isn't it?
It was technically – I mean, there's a bunch of cases pending because of each state. Like in this case, it was Kentucky and Arkansas, but there's about seven or eight states that have work requirements at various stages, including my own in Michigan. In some cases they're pending. In some cases they've already been put in place, like in Arkansas and New Hampshire, in Indiana, I believe. In some cases they've been approved, but they've been approved, but they don't actually go into effect. But in Michigan, the law was passed at the state level. The waiver was approved by CMS. But it doesn't actually go into effect until next year. And so this ruling, nobody's quite sure how this ruling is going to affect other states because, like in Michigan, unfortunately, the way that the state law was written, it included provisions that basically say if the work requirement part is not allowed, is shot down by a judge, that it is not severable in this case. But in this case, that the entire Medicaid expansion program in Michigan would cease to be altogether.
Oh my gosh!
Instead of 10 or 20,000, or say 50,000 people losing coverage with the work environment, means that all 700,000 or whatever would be off. And so that puts we have newly elected Democratic governor Gretchen Whitmer, who campaigned strongly on protecting Medicaid expansion in Michigan for 700,000 people. This puts her in a hell of a bind because she does not want work requirements. She is opposed to them. She just wants straight Medicaid expansion, as is a good thing. But the problem is that if the judge rules against that legally, she may be required to include the work requirements, whether she wants to or not, because otherwise everybody gets kicked out.
Could she flip things on the GOP and say that the work requirement is 5 minutes. And if you call in and make your monthly report with whomever you're supposed to report to, that counts as your 5 minutes?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the exact wording of the law, but what I would say is that certainly, as has been proven the opposite way in every state, like in Arkansas, over 18,000 people, they started enforcing government, I think it was like last summer, and since last fall, and since then, over 18,000 people have been kicked off Arkansas alone. And the main reason that they found, the main reason why they're being using covered, it's not necessarily that they aren't complying, it's that it's next to impossible to prove that you're complying, because what they did in Arkansas, like the website where you're supposed to report your hours and such, is offline for 12 hours a day, for no reason, just from like... Like 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. or something like that. It's just they take it offline. And there's no reason, you know, it's a website. There's no reason to take it offline.
Wouldn't that take more work than just leaving it up?
Yes. You have to, I believe, in a couple states, I think including Arkansas, you have to report it through the website. You can't just call it in. You can't, like, you know, fax it in. You have to do it through the website. Well, Arkansas has a lot of rural communities, which is where a lot of people on Medicaid live, right? Not everybody has internet access. Not everybody has, you know, a computer. Not everybody has, you know, access to a local library where they can borrow their computer. So
then someone gets a smartphone and gets attacked by conservative pundits for spending money on a smartphone while they're on Medicaid.
Exactly.
Because they need the smartphone to access the system.
Right. So exactly. And so they put all these ridiculous hoops for people to you know, that they have to jump through, to make it nearly impossible to actually comply, and then say, see, they didn't comply, they're lazy bums, kick them off. Now, to your question about in Michigan or other states, could the reverse, I mean, is it possible that they could just have, you know, that the government could officially, you know, that the state could officially enforce the work requirements and just be extremely lenient about it? You know, I'm sure they would never do that, you know, on purpose. I don't know, you know, I don't know how much leeway she has. I would have to read the exact wording of it. And if they did, then I'm sure they would be sued for failing to enforce and so forth. Having said that, the irony of all this, going back, and I'm gonna tie this back to the individual mandate, is that we're in the middle of tax filing season right now, right?
Yes.
The ACA individual mandate, the great irony of them repealing it and thus reading this lawsuit, is that the individual mandate is still in place for 2018, which means that there are several million people nationwide who officially do have to pay, if they did not have ACA compliant coverage, they will have to pay that $700 a head. For not having coverage last year. Now, what the CMS has done, like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, what they did is they had the IRS change the wording and change the layout of the 2018 1040 form for filing federal taxes. There used to be, because there are some people who do get waivers, and there are people who are exempt from having to pay the penalty. And there are several different reasons, you know, there's a checklist about it, you know, doesn't, well, I shouldn't have to pay because this. And one of those is just sort of a general hardship exemption. And what you used to have to do is you used to have to actually prove that you had a hardship, right? You would have to, basically CMS would have to review your case, and they would issue a number that says, okay, here's the number, and then you would have to enter this number into the form. This year, the IRS, they changed it so that now that hardship exemption is basically on the honors system. Basically, you just check a box that says, yeah, I had a hardship, and so I don't have to pay. And that's it. And there's no, like, legal, like, you don't have to prove it, you don't have to file any, you know, send any paperwork that your house burned down or anything like that. You just, you know, you basically just say, yeah, I had a hardship. So, if they can do that, you know, I'm not a lawyer.
Well, I was going to say, you do, however, sign that tax return saying under penalty of perjury, right, everything on this form is true.
Exactly. So, I don't know. I mean, You know, here in Michigan, we used to, up until this year, we had a, for voting, we had for, if you wanted to vote absentee, you know, if you wanted to vote absentee, in order to vote, get an absentee ballot, you had to choose from several reasons. Like, you had to say that, it's a religious holiday that day, or, you know.
Oh, yeah, you're going to be traveling.
Right. And one of the reasons was, I expect to be out of town on election day. Well, it doesn't say you have to be out of town. It says you expect to be, you know,
right,
or plan to be. And so, you know, I'm sure no one would ever do this, of course, but in theory, one could just check that box and then, oh, it turns out I wasn't. You know?
I can't imagine doing that. Who would think such a thing?
Now, fortunately, they got rid of that starting this year. There was a new bill passed, ballot proposal was passed that says that, you know, that basically anyone can vote absentee with no reason needed. But yeah, I mean, it might fall into that sort of fuzzy area, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We really so much appreciate your time, and we hope we can impose upon you again when things go wonky with the ACA in the future, because, you know, it's coming. It will. We'll be back here on Hopping Mad.
Back to Hopping Mad. There are a lot of interesting stories happening in our country right now, especially as it relates to the Democratic Party and 2020. And we've sort of been covering Brexit and federal debt and all this other stuff, but we'd like to, you know, turn our attention back to the U.S. because we are a U.S.-based political and economic podcast. And so, Arlis, you and I were talking the other day about the goings on in the House and Senate and Pelosi's leadership.
Yeah, I tweeted in basically to Kegro's show because Armando and Kegro were talking about impeachment and talking about why they were both being a little mystified as to why Nancy Pelosi has so firmly come out and said impeachment really isn't on her menu right now. That it's that he's not worth it. That whole what turned into be a whole blow up on Twitter. But what I tried to say, and I think I was not understood because, you know, making yourself understood on Twitter is not always a perfect science. What I tried to say was, first of all, I have all faith that Pelosi has a plan and that she's marching in absolute lockstep with Schumer. And I think her priority, I believe that she thinks we're going to get the White House. I think her priority in life is two things. One, to help Schumer win the Senate. And that's the very top of the hit parade because it's the court, stupid. Armando has said that over and over and over. He's right. It's not just even just the Supreme Court. It's the courts, period, as we know. We're going to need to expand the federal bench all over the country to recover from this decimation of the bench that Trump has perpetrated. And then the next thing that comes to that is that I think Pelosi has been looking at issues polling in all of the sensitive Senate districts and some of her most sensitive House districts. I think she knows what we all know, which is that healthcare is the top of everyone's hit parade. And she's happy, and I think more than happy, to have investigations going on in the House right now. And I think she'll stay on top of that, and I think she'll back her people in doing that. What I ultimately believe is that she wants to stay for the 2020 election laser focused on healthcare. And impeachment would pull everybody's attention off of that. And it would make the Democrats look like we're playing inside baseball. And I think if something comes out of the Mueller report that makes it absolutely clear that the president must be impeached, and frankly, I think those things are already all over the place anyway, but the reality is, I think Pelosi knows what it's going to take to win the White House, the Senate, and the House. I think that's what she's trying to do, and in that way, I trust her. Who we pick as a president will have an awful lot to say about how effective her strategy ultimately is in the longer run. And so that has a great deal to stay here, but I think she's all about getting a Democratic Senate. And I think that's where her plan is.
I think so. I think also she is well aware of the successes and failures of Congress with the current makeup. The Kavanaugh fight really illustrated the kind of fight you need to have in this divided Congress if you want to have a victory. And the allegations against Kavanaugh were important. They needed to be heard, but that was not going to move Republicans because Republicans don't care about women. Where we should have been having that Kavanaugh fight was over the torture issue, and not just torture. That shouldn't have been an issue, but the perjury that Kavanaugh committed over torture. When Kavanaugh was first put on the federal bench, he said he had nothing to do with any of the decisions the Bush administration made about torture. And then it turns out there are a bunch of documents from the Bush administration with his signature on them. So he told a bold-faced lie to Congress under oath. That is a fight that you could potentially have gotten Republicans in on. And so one of the reasons she's focused on these investigations as well is because those investigations are the only way we're going to uncover the kind of evidence that might shift Republicans. And with the nature of the Senate right now, if we're going to impeach, we need it to be a situation like with Nixon, where even the Republican Party looks at each other and says, yeah, this guy has to go, because the evidence that comes out is damning even in their eyes. And the only way she's going to win that fight, the only way it's possible to win an impeachment fight, is if these investigations go forward, which is why she's focusing on those investigations. That is where the strategy needs to go. And she's actually working really, really well with, and so is Elizabeth Warren in the Senate. Sorry about the awkward cut there, folks. They decided to test the tornado warning system in the middle of our podcast recording. But what I was saying was that we have a team of strategists like Pelosi who are interested in winning the fight in the long term, that are interested in getting legislation passed. And then we've got people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Adam Schiff and this whole bank of Democrats that are the tacticians who are good at winning the day, who are good at winning the current 24-hour news cycle and keeping us focused on things. And they're working really, really well together, which is good to see. For example, after the Republicans decided to play games with the Green New Deal in the Senate so that even the Democrats who had endorsed it and supported it couldn't vote for it, they voted present on it because the Republicans were playing legislative games. AOC and Elizabeth Warren sat down and had lunch. Like, they're on the same team. They're fighting for the same things, and they are working well together.
And that doesn't happen by accident. That is leadership-driven. Leadership makes that happen.
And you see the difference between our party and the Republicans after you had that Tea Party wave. We have a lot of progressive Democrats who've come in, people who, you know, want change very much in this country, who are driven by popular forces. And unlike the Tea Party, where they took out their own leadership and they led to the current Republican group that can't get anything done, we've got some people in power right now that once we take the Senate back are going to be able to work together to get lots and lots of progressive legislation through. So we don't have, even though we're as a political party, we've got our divisions, our legislative party in Congress is not engaging in fratricide and eating itself.
Yeah.
So this is really good to see. You also had an anecdote about someone trying to bring in legislation that I thought was pretty good, Arliss.
Oh, this is hilarious. A young, one of the new freshman congressmen, you know, was talking to Pelosi. He's in her office, and this and I forget who it was. I would tell you if I could remember, but and he says, "Yeah, I want to introduce this the Monday after next." And she says, "No," and he said, and he says, "Well, it's really important, blah blah blah. This is a very important bill." And she says, "Yes, it is." And he says, "So I want to introduce it the Monday after next." And she says, "No." And he says, "Why? Are you trying to put this off? Or are you trying to avoid it?" And she says, "Look at the date." And so this goes back and forth and back and forth. And she keeps saying, "Look at the date." And finally, she picks up a calendar and points to the date, and it's April Fool's Day. You know, Pelosi has a plan, I'm not saying she's always perfect, but I think she's pretty considered. So, when people are melting down about her not getting behind impeachment, I think that when Mueller report is released to Congress and then to the population, if from the base of the population, there rises up a "we must impeach him now" wave, then Pelosi will get on that. I have no doubt, but I have absolute doubt that if it doesn't come from the bottom to the top, she's not going to push it. She's going to stay focused on the election and on health care. And frankly, that's what it takes to win an election. So given the danger of the current administration, given the danger that Trump represents to this country, I think her priorities are in the right place. If it was somebody like George H.W. Bush, I'm not saying I agreed with him on, anything, but he wasn't going to start a nuclear war or pull us out of NATO or close the southern border completely, or he wasn't going to do insane things. He was going to do things I disagreed with, but he wasn't going to do insane things. And I think she's legitimately worried about those things. And frankly, me too. And I'm all about prioritizing that.
On that note, I don't think Trump is going to close the southern border because there are a lot of really, really wealthy Republicans who like their avocados.
And car companies who like being able to get their product moving back and forth.
Yeah, and there's the car companies, and there's all this other trade that we have with Mexico, that if he closes that, it's going to wreck parts of the economy, and we're going to run out of avocados, which is a major food that lots and lots of people, rich and poor alike, like. I did point out that avocado thing to a friend of mine who's also on a low-carb diet, and they're worried because avocados are a healthy fat that are sort of the base of a lot of American diets right now in a lot of ways. So I think it would be a good thing for the country if he were to do something rash like that that had a temporary effect on grocery store shelves, because then people would actually, maybe get it without it ruining livelihoods if he does something worse.
What I think, though, is that for his base, I think that he would find a way to say it's the Democrats' fault and they would believe him. Fox and Friends would back him up and they would believe them. So I don't know. I think we need to hope that calmer heads prevail on that. The other thing that I think is interesting did you have any more on that?
I did not.
The other thing I think is really interesting, and I'm feeling kind of sparky about this, is that, the rise of Pete Buttigieg. First of all, he's freaking everywhere. I don't know who he's got managing the media on his campaign and getting him booked on basically everything short of this show. I mean, he's everywhere. But in addition to that, his book is doing well, and he raised $7 million, which for somebody who was no one, 4 weeks ago, in terms of national visibility, $7 million. He wasn't Kamala Harris, who started campaigning a year ago, basically. He wasn't. So that explains the difference between $7 and $12 million. Also, he's not in California. And I actually am starting to get hopeful about Buttigieg. I still don't know that he's a president, but he's certainly a vice president. And I'd be thrilled to see him as president. I would be absolutely thrilled. Yeah. He still needs to prove to me that he's the guy who can beat Trump. And nobody has proven that to me yet. That's the element that I'm still waiting to see, that definite I can beat Trump thing. I think that's the uphill climb for every single one of them. So I'm excited that Buttigieg is doing so well right now.
Yeah, on some of the sort of nastier side of political strategy stuff, he's also doing the things he needs to do to sort of appear to be a moderate in certain folks' eyes, which is, I guess, where he thinks he needs to be. Because he's LGBT, so he's going to have LGBT bona fides, which let him reach out to the centrists by saying, I think being mad at Chick-fil-A is virtue signaling. Which, he's wrong about, I think. But he is using this language that will reach out to sort of the people who are centrists because they like the idea of being centrists rather than, rational, middle-of-the-road folks. So he's definitely finding his battle lines and trying to both reach out to the left by being the LGBT candidate and talking about jobs. Especially when he talks about Indiana, he says, we have this old plant in the middle of our town, and that's never going to be a car company factory again, but it can be something new. The old jobs aren't coming back, but we can build new ones, which is progressive language that I like.
And so he's brought a ton of jobs into town. He's done an incredibly good job with South Bend. So in extremely difficult times and in a part of the state that uphill work for him. This was not an easy job. So the thing about Buttigieg that I think in terms of...
Well, if I could just finish my...
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, that's fine. But the thing I was trying to say, though, is he is trying to appeal to everyone in the Democratic Party, and he's doing it in a way that seems pretty legitimate. Like, that's the strategy here, is he's going for it all, and that's why he's everywhere, is he's trying to reach out to every single demographic and group within the Democratic Party. So I don't know if he's got my vote yet, but it'll be interesting to see how this thing develops. And I sort of am seeing the strategy he's using, and I'm appreciating it. Because if he can keep this strategy going and not have any stumbles, he's one of the people that's very likely to win the Democratic nomination if everything that he's doing now plays out the way he wants it to. That's just the point I wanted to make, is that his strategy is to have that broad base of appeal. And it's kind of working. Anyway, you were saying, Arliss.
Yes. If you jump forward and just sort of go into an imaginary place... If he was to win the nomination, the coasts are wrapped up, right? The liberal elite on both coasts, they're wrapped up because they're going to vote for a Democrat no matter what in order to beat Trump. So the battle is going to be the South and the Midwest, mm-hmm. and how we wage that war in those states is going to be tricky. And I think that Buttigieg has a better plan for the Midwest than anybody else I've seen. Because I'll absolutely tell you that Bernie doesn't have it and Kamala Harris doesn't have it. Mm-hmm. Cory Booker has a pretty... He needs to get a lot more specific. I don't think that he is a policy guy, and I think that's going to start to be a real problem for him.
Yeah,
because always Buttigieg... being a congressman, he is a policy guy, but he's not talking policy right now, and he might need to be.
Yeah, what Buttigieg is doing, which is what I think Booker needs to do, is he's like, okay, these are the specific things I did and I can do that we can replicate across the entire country.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we can do. Like that's where Buttigieg is really rocking it. In addition to doing all the other folksy, here I am, you know, handshaking and baby kissing. That's the political campaign stuff. Cory Booker's good at the handshaking and the baby kissing. He's got that part down. He does need to get specific on those. Here's what I'm going to do as president.
Buttigieg is, by the way, is a veteran.
Yeah.
So I think that will play to his advantage. I'm sorry.
And as far as the Midwest is concerned, just to say this about Buttigieg, I think he's got a lot of opportunities in the Midwest because he comes from Indiana, because he can say your towns are just like mine. They've got the same problems that mine have. I was able to do this for my town. I want to do this for every town in America. He's got that opportunity. So yeah. I think the Rust Belt states are a potential lock for Buttigieg too, because those areas are fine with voting for Democrats. They're battleground states, but he's going to be able to come and hit those voters at exactly the notes they need to be hit. It's like, you know, you need jobs. You've been asking for jobs since, I don't know, 2004. That's what I want to do for you.
And so, I honestly think that I've been worrying about, all the headlines where the very first thing they talk about is Buttigieg being gay. And, you know, the concept is that he's much, much more. Yeah, but that's, you know, he's much, much more than a gay man in terms of, how we need to talk about him and think about him. And, of course, that's true for any person. But
the thing is, he's exactly what a lot of us want an LGBT leader. He is a leader who happens to be LGBT.
That's right.
And the media portrayal is a lot like, well, he's a gay guy. He's the gay guy is how they're trying to portray it.
And that's annoying to me, but and problematic.
And annoying to all of us LGBT folks too. Like we're more than just our.
So, but I think the place I was going is that the Christian right, they're going to vote for the Republicans no matter what. That's a lost number to us, I think. So I am, the more I think about it, the less I am worried about the LGBT issue right now. And in fact, the more I'm starting to view it as possibly advantageous, just because it allows him to speak in a very authentic way to some folks who were pretty upset in 2016.
You know, I'd agree with that. And I think one of the main issues that is like the people that a lot of us sometimes worry about aren't going to vote for Democrats anyway. And there's this thing that we sometimes do where we want to get the margins. And it's the Karl Rove effect. Karl Rove was able to pick away certain portions of what's traditionally the Democratic coalition. And our response is to try to do the same thing, but we're not going after the winnable voters. The Christian right is not going to vote for Democrats ever. So stop trying to win their votes. Stop worrying about, you know, votes we can't win. Because the Christian moderates in this country don't care about LGBT people. That swings both ways. They're not going to fight to protect our rights, but they also don't care about anything we do. And they're fine to let us alone and let us live our lives. Those moderate Christians can be won, but they're not going to be turned off by the LGBT stuff. They're more interested in, well, the jobs side of things.
And healthcare.
And healthcare,
that's right.
So you don't win those voters by worrying about the LGBT stuff. People who hate LGBT folks are not going to vote Democrat anyway. And the people you can win don't care. So we need to stop worrying about replicating some Republican narcissistic version of public piety, because those folks aren't going to vote or care about us anyway.
Yeah.
And the other voters you can win on other issues.
That's right. So I'm glad to see the rise of Buttigieg, and I hope he continues to do well. He's had a really, really effective launch, and he must have brought into his campaign some extremely effective tacticians. So and strategy folks.
Yeah, I agree. And it'll be interesting to see. We're saying about Kamala Harris. I don't know if you feel this way, but I kind of feel like she's an empty shirt at this point of a candidate. She's an empty suit. Like that's how I've started to see her candidacy. She's had this long launch and she gives speeches and she's just not particularly exciting to me.
Well, I think she speaks really, really well. I think if you hear her in person speaking, you are super impressed. I think she does a really good job with that. I think that the rest of it is in terms of what she's backing that up with. That's a problem for me, and I still have the problem that she's a prosecutor, and I personally just, that's a problem for me. I still would like to find out what Stacey Abrams is going to do. I'm still hoping that Biden stays out, and because I'm not really interested in putting somebody older than me in the White House anymore. I think I'm done with people in their 60s and 70s in the White House. I just don't see that that's advantageous to this country at this point in time, given the issues that we face. I think we need people who have an absolutely current and modern perspective and an understanding of technology that people in the generations above me and in my generation don't access very well.
Mm-hmm. I'd agree with that. And I think, look, I've talked with a lot of millennials whose perspective of like, we're just basically waiting for the boomer political class to die so that our lives can start, because our generation has been screwed over and over again, and that's unfair. But I do think that we need Gen X leaders and we need millennial leaders at this point to fix the country, because the political class of the boomer generation hadn't really been able to get it done.
Well, it's very interesting. As I mentioned to folks, I read four biographies or autobiographies about women during Women's History Month, and I read four novels, famous novels by women during Women's History Month. And two of the biographies that I read really shaped my thinking and honed my thinking on a couple of things. First of all, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Life, that biography. This is the big, almost 600-page biography that was released at the end of last year. So it goes in, it drills down into great detail. And RBG's, when you look back at where women were in society in terms of their legal standing, etc., in the generation right before mine, so my mother's generation, and in my generation, the difference, the distance we have come is staggering. It is absolutely staggering. And I did not really absorb that until this book made me go backwards and concentrate on it. And sometimes I think that millennials think that we've just been sitting around all this time and forget that some of the things that are just seem like they are in the air, the way it's always been, are things that my generation and my mother's generation had to fight for.
Yeah, they don't remember the fight over the ERA. We don't remember the lost fights. We don't remember the victories. We don't really pay. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, if I'm remembering this correctly, was a friend of Harvey Milk. She was there in California for that fight. And there's a tendency, especially when it comes to women, for millennials to, a lot of us don't know the history. We don't know the political history of this country. And we don't know that these folks have been in the trenches fighting. And so we blast the older generations for not being as progressive as we are. And then we totally discount all the work that they've done to get us to this place. And then, you know, especially for female leaders, there's the ingrained sexism that my generation still needs to disabuse ourselves of. Because sexism is one of the trickiest beasts of all the social ills we have, as far as how we treat people poorly and think of people differently, because it crosses ethnic, cultural, social, and economic lines and religious lines. It's everywhere. So pinning it down requires a real intersectional view of how all these things happen. So,
and you hear that kind of bias when you hear what people say about Nancy Pelosi, Elizabeth Warren, what they said about Hillary Clinton. Those older women have been bearing the brunt of millennial bro, in particular, fragile masculinity or something. I don't quite know what to call it, but
they really have, and they'll continue to until we can kind of disabuse ourselves. You know, I think one of my favorite people who's talked about this is a folk singer named Grace Petrie out of the UK. And she had a song about the death of Margaret Thatcher, which is one of the lines was the BBC will wring their hands to play a word like witch, and the left will cry out feminism, but still use words like bitch.
Yep.
And it's that sort of thing where we need to disabuse ourselves of the ingrained sexism that still exists, and the ways that we need to think about things, and how that sexism that's cultural still needs to be gotten rid of, even in millennial culture. And you can see that on our own side, where progressive men can be really shitty allies. And we can also see that among young conservatives with the movements like, well, Gamergate, which we talked about in the past,
yeah.
and that kind of the attack on women in electronic workspaces and on the internet and all that. So there's still work to be done on that front. And I think we need to pay attention make sure that if we are criticizing someone like Kamala Harris, it's because she was a prosecutor. And because, you know, she does give some great speeches, but I still really don't know what she's for.
Yeah.
And make sure that our criticisms are around those things and not around the sexist side of things.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely one of the things that AOC and other progressive women are getting blasted for, too. Like they attack AOC for her clothing and what she eats and all this other stuff. And like the right is obsessed with attacking her for everything they can attack her for. And we need to make sure that we're not participating in that sort of thing too. Anyway, yeah. You were saying.
So the other book that I read that I recommend to everybody, if I could recommend to you one book to drop everything and go out and get and read, it's Claire Evans' Broadband. Two words, Broadband. And it's about the history of the women who invented the internet. You are going to be shocked at how deeply women were involved in the invention of the internet and how important their roles were, because we all view this as a male-dominated field. And women were absolutely there every step of the way. And the thing that most blew my mind is that I worked for a lot of this time. I worked in a think tank in Silicon Valley at the time, I started out I started out using DARPANET and ARPANET before the internet was around, right? So when they talk about early adopters, I'm like a pre-early adopter. And so I was there using these tools as they came into being, and it was there in the air of everything that was around me. I never remember seeing women involved or making the presentations or mentioned in the articles or taking any of the credit. And I never really focused on it before. And this book is absolutely mind-blowing, so much so that I'm going to go back and read it again, because I had such a shift while I was reading it. I should have known better, right? I, of all people, right? Who was fighting every day, fighting for, myself in that very much male culture. I should have known that there were other women out there. I was at Stanford Park Research all the time. Really, really frequently during this period of time. And one of the women that was there at the time is basically where we get the DNS register and is the person who came up with the whole sort of organization for the internet. And when they mention her name in the book, and I can't even tell you right now because it slipped my mind, but when Claire mentions her name in this book, I thought, oh, isn't that somebody? Haven't I met her? I mean, it was that, the overlap was that great. And yet, I didn't get it. And so I really recommend that you find this book, that you read it or listen to it. It's absolutely terrific. It's a short book, a relatively short book. It's very, very accessible to read. You do not have to be, a wonk in any way to get enormous benefit from this book. And it's extremely engaging. So I just, Broad Band by Claire Evans, Claire L. Evans, absolutely top notch. So folks, thank you all for joining us today. Will and I send out our thanks to our show's editor, Michelle LeSure. Michelle makes it possible for us to do this by taking the editing efforts off our hands after we record these shows. The full podcast version of our show is available on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Radio Public, Spotify, and others. Our website is imhoppingmad.com. You can listen to, download, or comment on the show there. We really love to hear from you, but we also have pretty consuming day jobs, so please understand if it takes a little bit for us to get back to you. For fast, short comment, you can find us on Twitter at imhoppingmad. Will is on Twitter at willmcleod99, and I'm there as, obviously, Arliss Bunny. Hopping Mad is your place for deep dive down the rabbit hole coverage of politics, economics, and, of course, carrots. Until next week, cheers.